Apple Radio, we feature a segment from our most recent Off the Hill political. This month, the theme was Off the Hill, dissecting the 2024 federal budget. Entitled Fairness for Every Generation, the federal does this budget's focus on how to build more homes faster to help make life cost less and grow the economy in a way that helps every generation get ahead. But will it? Our expert panel of guests dissected this and more on Off the Hill this week. Our guests included economist at the Center for Future Work, Jim Stanford, senior economist at the Canadian Center for Policy, David McDonald, and writer and policy researcher, Chuka Ijekam, co-hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Here is a small clip from that panel. Take a listen.
Well, another federal budget. We've done quite a few now, Robin, haven't we? So I'm going to start with a question for all of our three panelists. And let's begin with, you know, Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland said 2 weeks ago, before the budget was released yesterday, that this would be, quote, unlock to a good middle class life for the next generation, end of quote. Well, now we know what the budget looks like, having heard it yesterday. So I guess my question to you is, what do you think? Will this budget make life more affordable for working Canadians? Jim, let's begin with you, and then we'll go to David and then Chuka.
Thank you, Libby, and thanks to Rabble for your fine coverage of the budget, including, if I can say, a commentary written by myself today that's on the Rabble site and other great analysis. That was my self-promotion moment. Well, Mr. Freeland invokes the famous term middle class Canadians. She probably said hardworking middle class Canadians. She probably meant hardworking, deserving, key voter middle class Canadians. It's a bit nauseating how they try to promote this. On the other hand, to be fair, the budget does contain a number of measures that absolutely are going to make a difference in the lives of what I would define as working class Canadians, as working and low income Canadians. A suite of measures, not one of them is a magic bullet, and they are not going to solve the cost of living crisis facing Canadians. I've been arguing that we need to remember it isn't government that caused this cost of living crisis. It's the private sector economy. It's businesses that charge too much for what they sell and don't pay enough so that workers can afford to buy back what they've produced. And so in that regard, expecting government to solve the cost of living crisis with any of these measures is placed. And I think we need to keep the main critical attention on the role of businesses, especially large corporations, in fomenting this moment. Again, that being said, the incremental measure in this budget will push in the right direction. And I think most Canadians will benefit from one or more of the different things in the budget, whether it's the housing supports, pharmacare and dental care, negotiated, of course, by the NDP, the expanded student loans and grants for university and college students, the free lunches for school students as that program rolls out, the Canada Disability as it rolls out. Those are all important, valuable things that will make an incremental difference and in that regard should be welcomed.
Just before I go to, maybe I could sort of flip the question over, Jim. So you've named some of the, you know, kind of more popular items that might resonate with people and might take us in a better direction. What about on the other side? I remember reading something about the capital, I forget what it was, the capital gains tax, that it sort of made it a better, like, per tax. Is still even way behind the U.S. Even Joe Biden has done a far better job of it. I think they're at 28%. We're still at 21%. So if we just sort of put away, any comment on sort of what the budget did on that side of things?
On the revenue side, if you like. Sure. Yeah. So there is some new spending. It's not enormous new spending. Never mind what Mr. Polyev or the C.D. Howe Institute or the business counselor are saying about opening the spending taps. Not remotely the case, but there is significant new spending. And the interesting point is they achieved that with no change at all in the deficit timetable. In fact, they're almost identical to what was in the budget last year. So Minister Freeland did keep her promise to stick to those targets. And the deficit is shrinking gradually over time and as a share of our GDP as well. How did they do that? Well, they paid for it with new revenue. And really, there was only one major new policy announced in the budget, and that is the change in what's called the inclusion rate for capital gains. Right. Capital gains is when you profit by buying low, selling high. You haven't done any work, right? You haven't produced anything. All you did was sell something for more than you paid for it. And in fact, if you're into derivatives, you can buy high and sell low and make money off of shorting the stock. So, you know, again, there's no productive direct function to capital gains. It's just a way of rewarding people who own financial wealth. And not surprisingly, the vast majority of capital gains are claimed by the very richest segment of society. So I think the government did a very clever job of tailoring this capital gains change. Only 40,000 Canadians who will pay more on their individual personal income tax because of it. The richest, not 1%, 0.1% of Canadians will be affected by it because of how they've designed the exemption. They'll now have to pay tax on 2/3 of their income instead of capital gains income, instead of just half at present. And that, by the way, that's still less than work to pay. Okay, so if you flip burgers at McDonald's for your living, you have to include all of your income. If you flip stocks and bonds, even with this change, you only have to incur 2/3. So All the whine from corporate Canada about this is nauseating and should be repulsed, really. And I think it does raise significant money, and it does something that progressives have called for many, many years, close down that loophole, which is absolutely just a giveaway for people with wealth.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for that, Jim. And now over to David, just your sort of take on the budget in terms of what was put out there a couple of weeks ago and what we actually saw. And if you want to also sort of address the revenue side in terms of, you know, should it have gone further in terms of raising in terms of the capital gains, any thoughts you have on that? So yeah, let's hear what your perspective is.
Yeah, on the capital gains, I mean, it's really actually quite surprising, the response in the business press, that this is the worst budget that Canada has ever passed in its history, because the wealthiest 40,000 people have to pay slightly less discount on their taxes than they got last year. Everyone's going to leave the country. The tech sector is going to evaporate. This must be canceled at all costs. And what's interesting is, you know, they may well win. I mean, this is what's interesting, is that the explosion in opposition in the business press and the fear-mongering that's occurred for people who on average are making $1.4 million and will be asked to pay what will get a discount on their tax, and they got it present. And they get 2 months grace, right? So they can sell all their stocks tomorrow and buy them all again the next day and stay at the 50% inclusion rate instead of the higher rate that's going to occur in June. And that this is the worst budget in Canadian history. It's pretty surprising, actually. Well, maybe it's not that surprising, but really the opposition is quite stunning, frankly. The other piece that's interesting is I'm not sure who the rich think should pay for the housing crisis and to fix it. You know, this budget is doing a fair amount on the housing file. I think with the money in the fiscal framework at this point, we're approaching the scale of the affordability crisis on the housing. This is heavily focused on rental construction. That's exactly where it should be focused. There are definitely things that we could do that would result in faster changes in rent that I think politically unpopular and are not being done. But in terms of the build side, I mean, we're getting close federally. Mm-hmm. We're not going to see the impact for a couple of years. I mean, that's worth pointing out, too. Mm-hmm. So the fruits of the labor will be enjoyed by the next government, whoever that government happens to be. Mm-hmm. But who should pay for these housing programs, right? Should it be the wealthy that benefited from these housing programs because portfolio exploded in value? Should they pay a little bit more in taxes as a result of this? Should their reduction in taxes be slightly less? Or should it be the regular Canadians who are getting killed by the affordability crisis and the housing front? And so, you know, I think this is going to be a fascinating debate to see over the course of, it's just heating up. Like, it's just starting. The business press, this is a complete surprise. I mean, this is worth pointing out, is it was a complete surprise, particularly to the business sector. It's not only, you know, it's certainly on the individual side where you've got these 40,000 very rich Canadians that will incur this tax. The other 40 million Canadians are never going to pay it. You're just, you know, if you've got a stock portfolio as an individual, you've got some retirement savings, that's all going to be protected. Doesn't apply to primary residences. You know, it only applies if you're trading substantial amounts of stocks and bonds or selling companies. But it also applies on the corporate side. So corporations also incur capital gains, and they will also have to pay, well, not to pay more, they will, but their discount is smaller on their taxes. They will still pay less than if compared to another company that's making money by selling goods and services. But it's making money trading assets will still pay less on that same amount of income. But they're very upset that that discount has been reduced. And so we're seeing it on the corporate side as well, just this huge explosion of opposition to this measure, which is very targeted. And that's one of the issues with targeting wealth at the very high end, is that these are absolutely the people who should be paying it. The trouble is they are really motivated and they have the means to make change because they can hire the best tax lawyers, they can hire the best lobbyists, they can hire the best accountants, and they can go to every single MP meeting till the end of time and scaremonger this till the cows come home in a way that no one else can because they're that motivated, because they have to pay for it, right? And it doesn't matter for them that it goes to this housing. You know, we think of housing as a problem. You know, renters are trying to go out to get a house, you know, rent a place and whatnot, and these housing costs are extremely high. It's a serious business problem as well. I mean, the business doesn't realize this, but it's tough to get workers because they can't live downtown anymore. Mm-hmm. And they're certainly not going to move to downtown Toronto or Vancouver from outside of the country to pay ordinary costs to buy or to rent in these big cities. It's a huge unrecognized issue in the business sector that mm-hmm. folks don't recognize, unfortunately. The business sector doesn't recognize a huge issue for unfortunately. So that's on the capital gains piece. I don't think this is over. This is not a done deal. I mean, the motive corporate and individual wealthy individuals just started to oppose this. And so we'll see whether they're successful. Technically, it comes into place on June 15th, but it really doesn't come into until the end of the fiscal year and when you have to file taxes. So that's going to be, you know, an end of April next year is when the real kind of deadline for this occurs. So we'll see whether it actually ever ends up going through without changes and a bunch of exemptions for the richest Canadians. They have the means to argue for that, and they will absolutely argue come tooth or nail. In terms of broader affordability, I think certainly housing, and we're going to talk about housing a bit more. I'd say we're now approaching the level of ambition that's required to have an impact here, but it's a way because of the build side. Now, that's not a bad approach, but it is focused on the build side. Some of the shorter-term measures that have gotten really good take-up, programs that got a ton of new funding this time around. So there is a new measure called the Rental Protection Fund, which one of the means government is providing a pool of loans and grants to nonprofit housing providers to outbid private investors for existing apartment buildings. So, you know, apartment buildings are always up for sale in a big city. They're always changing hands. And this is a way that, you know, nonprofit providers can scoop those out of the for-profit market, scoop it out of the hands of private investors who would jack the rent up and keep rents lower. The trouble is, like a previous program, the Rapid Housing Initiative, it'll be heavily oversubscribed. So housing providers will love it. They'll try to use it, but they'll just flood the first window with applications. And so it won't go very far, I don't think, in terms of actually affecting rent costs right now. The other big things that'll have an impact on housing affordability is lower interest rates. One of the reasons why housing is so unaffordable is because interest rates are high. We are in this weird circumstance where high interest rates are causing high inflation because housing affordability has been such an important driver of CPI. It's so overwhelming in terms of drive. And look, the other big piece is rent controls. Closing rent control loopholes as they presently exist at the provincial level or implementing them at all. I mean, you have provinces like Alberta that have no rent controls whatsoever. These are ways that you could have a more rapid impact on rental costs. But the federal government is not interested in touching this with a 10-foot pole. Mm-hmm. They do have this renter's bill of rights that they're going to try to their way. You know, they're going to try to buy their way to better regulation through a new $5 billion fund for the provinces. They're going to try to encourage the provinces to take this money, but also implement the renter's bill of rights. Renter's bill of rights could have some limits on increases in rent, but it doesn't at present. So, I mean, a lot of folks advocate for it, but This is the trouble, is that when you start talking about renters and limiting the potential profit of investors, no one's interested all of a sudden in housing affordability, right? It's one of the real touchy subjects in Canada.
I think you've hit on a very key point, and that is, you know, it's who wins the narrative as well, right? As you say, the business community, the corporate community sort of explodes in their opposition, and they have huge influences in the corporate media, which is why we like to do sort of, you know, progressive independent media analysis here on rabble.ca to look at a budget. But considering the number of people impacted, but their impact on the broader public discourse is probably going to be huge, way out of proportion in terms of what they should be paying. So I think that demonstrates a very good point about, you know, a budget is also about a narrative and who's winning that narrative. And I guess we'll see what happens. Just bringing in Chuka now. Chuka, I'm sure you have a very good perspective on the budget in terms of who got helped, who didn't, whether or not these commitments feel real to you or not, what we can see from that. So feel free to jump in and tell us what you think.
While acknowledging what David and Jim have said about how particular measures will help people in particular circumstances, I do think there is still the fundamental problem that the government treats the market and treats wage labor market or commodity markets or what have you, dominated by profiteers, as though it were a fundamental law of the universe, as opposed to being something that's ultimately subject to law, regulation, and governance. Whether it's the cost of housing or the cost of groceries or whatnot, in all of these circumstances, there are not only major profiteers, but also profiteers who at very least collude, if not openly or if not directly coordinate. All of them have interests that are aligned. And so opposing any attempt by government to reduce their ability to extract profit from people's lives. And I think in particular, we're talking about groceries and housing. These are things without which you will die. The idea that others are allowed to profit simply from the fact of your existence, I think reflects a deeply unserious posture toward policymaking. Given that the government is intent upon imagining this sort of profit-dominated structure of society was immovable or unchangeable, then its only way to attempt to create change is by seeking to incentivize profiteers in some way or another, usually by granting them public money, whether it's directly through rebates or for, you know, changes in whatever their production processes or what have you. I mean, you know, it ends up being based on the industry, but ultimately, you know, even in the circumstance that you raised, David, where the government can give a grant to a non-profit property owner so that they can bid against for-profit property owners, if the person who sell, or if the entity that's selling the property is seeking profit, then that non-profit property owner is still having to bid against for-profit property owners who. So even if the for-profit property owner doesn't get it, ultimately, they are still determining the public money that is being used, both the competing bidders and the person who's owning the property. And this is, you know, these are not solutions, right? Like these are attempts to minimize the damage of the problem. But we live in a circumstance in which everything in our society is subject to the whims of profiteers. Like, not only is that impractical, as we see in the oil and gas sector, it's literally terminal. We cannot progress as a society until we succeed in preventing profiteers from the course of our civilization, which we have, you know, failed to do. Obviously, it's not as simple as, you know, voting for it. I understand that, but you know, I think this is the fundamental problem that. It appears in housing, it appears in education, it appears in access to food, healthcare, all of these things. And even without discussing decommodification, which I understand is verboten in this hemisphere, the government can control prices. The government can even take possession of properties if necessary. The government can declare public emergencies and crises. There's reason to contend the affordability of housing, lacking access to housing, is a crisis in many ways.
So even within the parameters of sort of operating in the marketplace, I take it you don't see anything sort of structural in the budget that has, and, you know, it's sort of a tweak here, a tweak there, a few kind of goodies, but there's nothing structural that hits you in terms of a change that would move us forward in a progressive way.
I would say don't think that I also agree that with, you know, David, that I don't think the government has fit for it, whether they think it's politically unfeasible or whether they're ideologically opposed to it, who can say? But certainly it's not something that they consider seriously.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Tuka. Thanks, folks. Well, you've actually hit on a good chunk of our next question.
That was a small clip from our most off-the-hill political panel featuring Jim Stanford, Tuka Ijekum, and David McDonald. To watch the full panel, please visit Rabble TV or our YouTube channel. And to be sure you don't miss the invitation to our next panel, please subscribe to Rabble's newsletter. Switching gears now, it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, we'll turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, labor unions had a mixed reaction to the announcement of the 2024 federal budget. The 2024-2025 federal budget saw some important steps made in improving income inequality and giving more support to working Canadians, programs like a national school food program and through increased taxes on the wealthy, but fell short when it came to other priorities for the labor movement. Missing from those like an expansion of the National Employment Insurance Program and more spending on health care. Also missing from the budget was adequate support for those who qualify for the new Canada Ability Benefit. The budget allocates just $2,400 a year for those who qualify, which amounts to just $200 a month. Staying in national news, over 700 speakers and activists attended the 2024 Democracy Exchange Conference in Toronto last week. Topics included Russian ambitions, the role of capitalism, online harassment, the role of media, and the election of far-right parties in Europe and beyond. The conference also held a series of workshops aimed at a variety of democratic issues, including what democracy itself could look like in the year 2050, and how best to promote and train future democratic leaders. This is the fifth year of the Democracy Exchange Conference, and this year's event was organized by the Ontario College of Art and Design, the Open Democracy Project, and the democracy think tank, the DS. In labor news, nurses in Alberta state that the provincial government is negotiating in bad faith about their futures and about where they will work. Earlier this year, the Conservative Alberta government under Premier Danielle Smith announced their intention to create a new Crown corporation to manage mental health care in the province. Nurses unionized with the United Nurses of Alberta say that they were not consulted when they were informed that their employment would be transferred from Alberta Health Services to the new Mental Health and Addictions Crown Corporation. United Nurses of Alberta state that this violates their unionized workers' right to choose who their employer is and demonstrates that the government has been negotiating in bad faith with their members. The move would affect around 3,200 United Nurses of Alberta members. United Nurses of Alberta filed a labor complaint against the province on April 8th. In environmental news, Indigenous leaders are condemning the Royal Bank of Canada, RBC, for silencing their voices at the company's recent annual meeting. Indigenous leaders and land defenders attended the April 11th meeting to send the message that they wanted RBC to stop financing the fossil fuel industry. RBC is the top in Canada of the fossil fuel industry, and globally, it ranks fifth. Indigenous leaders were given just 60 seconds to speak at RBC's annual general meeting, and they were often cut off and interrupted by RBC executives and shareholders. Additionally, police were often seen nearby these activists when they tried to speak. The Indigenous leader said that in both the way RBC spends its money and in the way that it treats speakers at its meetings is no way for a bank to operate. And finally, in Alberta news, Rabl contributor David Kleimenhage reports that Premier Danielle Smith is trying to force her extreme right-wing ideology on municipalities and post-secondary institutions. Smith announced last week her intention to pass legislation that would block federal funding to municipalities and universities in the province that were engaged in projects or research that her government disagreed with. Smith, who is known for her anti-vaccine and other anti-science stances, stated that it was her government's responsibility to ensure that municipalities and universities were engaged in activities that Albertans agreed with, regardless if they were funded by the federal government. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabl.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabl Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabl Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabl Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabl. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabl.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabl.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning to Rabl Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
This is Sukyun Lee, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby.
Hey folks, Joey KS here, and you are listening to Oh No Radio on CJSF 90.1 on that FM dial. We're broadcasting to you over the stolen and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Peoples. On today's show, we got an hour of great local music for you. We're going to be kicking things off with some brand new Parlor Panther. They just released their album Bloom a couple of weeks ago. And we're going to be kicking things off with the title track from that album. It's a fantastic listen. There's a great music video that goes along with it as well. And very excited to play that track on the show for you today. And what better time to be playing a